This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Dr. Janet Woodcock is the director of the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, CDER, at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Dr. Woodcock has led many of FDA's drug initiatives. She introduced the concept of risk management in 2000 as a new approach to drug safety. Since 2002, she has led the Pharmaceutical Quality for the 21st Century Initiative, FDA's successful effort to modernize drug manufacturing and its regulation. In 2004, she introduced FDA's Critical Path Initiative, which is designed to move medical discoveries from the laboratory to consumers more efficiently. Most recently, Dr. Woodcock launched the Safety First and Safe Use initiatives designed to improve drug safety management within and outside FDA, respectively. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the IA Global Forum. Dr. Woodcock joins us today to discuss the recent PDUFA and 21st Century Cures legislation, their impact on healthcare and product development in the U.S., and related topics. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Woodcock.
Hi.
Dr. Woodcock, you have recently talked about moving beyond randomized clinical trials, RCTs. Can you tell us what is your current view about this move from the traditional gold standard of clinical research? What does it really mean in practice for the regulator?
Let's step back a bit. I was asked to talk at a New York Academy of Science meeting that was about beyond randomized clinical trials. I really talked about what is the modern clinical trial going to look like, and it wasn't about beyond randomized clinical trials. So actually, if you think, quote, the gold standard, first-in-human studies often aren't randomized. Some other types of studies in oncology may not be randomized. So there's always a range of types of studies that are conducted depending on the kind of question that's being asked. And there may be increased use of randomization in some settings, and in other settings we may see less randomization. And, you know, in my talk, I went through some of the circumstances.
So there's no different implication for regulators at this time. I was wondering whether, you know, the CDER review divisions, what they think about moving beyond randomized clinical trials, would they resist such a move, or is this really not an issue?
It really depends on the question. I mean, if you're asking a question, if there's a, you expect a small treatment effect, not a home run in a predictable a disease with otherwise predictable outcomes, then randomization is the best tool to discern a difference. Randomization is a tool by which you can separate signal from noise and be more confident that you have done that. And that's why it's a very valuable tool, and I don't think it's going to go away. But we were told, for example, by Congress in December when they passed the Cures Act that we should consider real-world evidence more. Much of current real-world evidence, of course, is not randomized. So we look at observational studies all the time for different things, safety outcomes, and so forth. So you really want the tool to fit the purpose, to fit the question that you're asking.
I guess some people would ask, is there a relative shift a little bit away from randomized clinical trials and more towards real-world evidence? And would companies need to think about the balance, the relative balance between the two in the total body of evidence that is presented for an NDA approval, for example?
Well, in general, you're not going to have real-world evidence unless a product is already on the market. So practically speaking, it may be useful for follow-on uses, for efficacy supplements, and as I said, it's used now extensively to address safety questions. So we will be putting out a whole portfolio of guidances, and we've been having workshops and meetings with various groups, including the National Academies, on this issue of how you might do this. We're also, though, very interested in the whole category. It's called evidence generation. A randomized clinical trial is one way to generate evidence. There may be other ways. We're very interested in doing randomization within healthcare and seeing if you can generate evidence that way in a way that's more efficient and less costly.
You mentioned a number of guidelines will be published. Can you give us an approximate time frame for the issuance of these guidances?
That's the one thing I can never give anybody because I don't control when guidances get out and are published. So we should be publishing, you know, some kind of overall framework for what we're going to be doing and so forth, but we will continue, there'll be workshops that people can attend and their publications from those, and then we will get out. We're supposed to develop a whole framework for how we're going to use real world evidence. That's part of CURES. So we will be doing that.
Understood. I had to ask. People want to know, but thank you.
People always want time frames, right?
Moving to another topic, specifically ultra-rare diseases. You mm-hmm. recently discussed FDA's application of the totality of evidence for ultra-rare diseases during yes. FDA's review of NDAs and perhaps BLAs. Would you please expand on this view?
Often for very, very rare diseases where, say, an ultra-rare disease, there is no formal definition, but you might say a disease where right at this moment in time, there are only 100 people in the world who are known to have this disease. That's a very rare disease, all right? And it's quite hard to study, and often you can't do randomized trials, and some of these diseases are rapidly fatal, for example. And so what we end up doing is looking at mechanism, pathophysiology, the natural history of the disease, and then look at the intervention, and can we discern whether it has altered the natural history. And in many cases, there aren't randomized studies. I have advised people many times, if they do randomized studies in these circumstances, they should randomize extremely early, and they should not do for rare fatal diseases. They should not do open label phase 2 studies, because they need to use every patient toward the evidence about the drug's effect.
Are there any recent examples where FDA and sponsors have incorporated this approach successfully?
Yes, well, we recently approved a biologic Brineura for Batten disease, for infantile Batten disease. It's a rare fatal disease of infants. And there we compared the intervention, which was done non-randomized because it was intraventricular into the brain, the ventricles of the brain, injection of the product, compared that to a natural history cohort of the disease. And that mm-hmm. we looked at all that evidence and were able to discern that the drug, you know, was reasonably likely to predict clinical benefit under those circumstances. I don't know whether that was a full approval or not. I don't remember. But anyway, we used that evidence.
This may be overreaching, but is this approach potentially applicable to diseases that are not ultra-rare?
Well, there you don't have the same problems of not having anybody study, really. And so you can usually study, you know, if it's feasible and practical to study people, you can usually find the answer out faster. Randomization will help you actually find out the answer faster. We're very interested in more efficient trials, things like master protocols and so forth that can, you know, be efficient machines for grinding out evidence, producing evidence. But I think people focus too much on randomization as some kind of barrier, when what it really is a tool to discern a result quicker or with less argument.
Could you remind our listeners about the nature of the master protocol and what is meant by it, please?
Typically right now, what we do for every, and when drugs are in development or any kind of clinical trial, you get together, you get an idea together, and then you have a group of thought leaders, and you think of a protocol, and then you go and contract with maybe a CRO, and they get a bunch of sites, and they train the sites, and they develop the documentation, the case report form, how the database is going to be structured, the procedures in the trial have to be standardized. You do all that, takes a year or two, and then you start the trial, and you enroll patients, and you get to the finish of the trial, and then you lock the database, you clean up the data, and you shut everything down, okay? Now, master protocol, you do more work up front. You set up an infrastructure with people who are committed to be investigators for quite some time, and then instead of studying a single product or intervention, you're trying to improve the disease. And so the master protocols that are currently ongoing will accept multiple different products or interventions, and we'll study those and study them until we find out what they were looking to find out, and then they leave the protocol and other interventions come in. And so you might have multiple sub-studies going on within the same master protocol. All that infrastructure is reused, and you can even use sometimes a common control group for some of the arms so that you save patients and time, and you can use adaptive designs. So These are modern approaches that save time and money, but they require more upfront planning.
Do these relate to what people are calling seamless clinical trials? And those people include Commissioner Gottlieb, I believe.
What I think he means is where there are adaptive trials where you do something. You may have a screening part of the program, and then you may seamlessly, in other words, you don't stop, shut everything down, put up another trial a year or two later that tests, you know, the next thing. You can move the intervention smoothly into, say, first you start with a dose finding or biomarker finding phase or determining the drug appears to be effective phase, and then you can seamlessly move into the pivotal trial phase using adaptive design. And many people would like to use Bayesian approaches that allow you to have some kind of prior probability, and FDA, CDER's certainly exploring how you would do that. But that's what seamless is, in my understanding. And there's some resistance to this in the pharmaceutical industry because you have to set up the rules in advance for that transition. And so you lose some control over your development program. And for example, biotech companies often, they'll finish a phase two and then they'll see, they'll have a signal, the drug is quote promising, then they can go out and raise more money. Okay, but if you already seamlessly went into the next phase, you've missed that money raising phase, right? Mm-hmm. And so it may not work commercially for everyone or for a variety of reasons, but as far as more efficiently developing evidence in the most timely way, that's probably the way to go.
Do I hear you say, perhaps between the lines, that CDER review divisions are open to the approach of seamless trials, as you've described them, and that some companies may be reluctant to take them up for the reasons you stated?
Yeah, absolutely. And probably a seamless master protocol would be the best of all possible worlds for people where you do your screening in phase two and you quote, seamlessly move, adaptively move into the efficacy portion. That would be the fastest route. And I think oncology here is talking to people about some of these. So yeah, we're open to it.
Moving to patients. Mm-hmm. FDA is working very hard to advance patient-focused drug development, the PFDD, as some people call mm-hmm. it. Over the years of putting together these PFDD meetings, FDA has received a wealth of feedback from patients. So the question is, how does FDA incorporate the feedback received in their review of INDs and especially NDAs?
Right. Well, I think this is changing with cures because cures now stipulates that we must talk about that, how we use patient input in our reviews. And so we're putting a special section into our benefit risk analysis so that we document how we did that. However, more broadly, this focus allows us to focus on, you know, what patients feel about the severity of the disease, their trade-offs that are acceptable as far as toxicity, and what they want to have ameliorated, and what we call a clinical, you know, the clinically meaningful effect, which might be misnamed, because what we really want is what effect is meaningful to the patient, what size of effect, right?
Right.
And it really helps when they talk about that, because we've had some patient-focused drug development meetings where the things and the size of things that the doctors thought were most important were not the way the patients would have structured them. And obviously, if patients are people taking the drug, they're assuming the risk. We ought to use their construct of what's important and how much is important when we make these judgments.
When patients want things measured in clinical trials that matter to patients but are not easily measurable in clinical trials, what is FDA's advice to companies? Are you expecting companies to figure this out? Or are companies, sponsors, expecting FDA to figure this out and provide guidance? What is your reading of this?
The ideal situation is that you develop instruments that can capture this information. Instruments meaning measurement systems. And
sure.
We're working with the PRO Consortium, Patient Reported Outcomes Consortium, and the CPAP Institute, and in other groups. NIH has the PROMISE initiative to be able to have instruments that capture things other than the classic clinical outcome measurements that we usually measure or often have measured. So I think this is a field that's really exploding and changing and growing, and we'll see a lot more. Particularly, people can use, almost everybody in this country apparently has a smartphone and knows how to use it. I have one. I'm not sure I know how to use it in all ways. But people can develop electronic devices that enable capture of what the patients are feeling. And in these instruments, they can fill out things so that we can get a much richer type of information from the patients than what we're used to. And we're certainly working with a bunch of developers who are trying to develop these applications.
Yes, I would say in the coming years, we're going to see a lot more wearable devices that will generate a lot of data. So would you say FDA is open to considering these types of devices and the data that would be arising from them?
Of course. I mean, this is valid information from the patients. And, you know, we're very interested in this. We just did an approval on a drug that decreases the symptoms of tardive dyskinesia, you know, which is a bad side effect of certain psychiatric drugs. And the company did videos. Now, that was videos that were, I think, done in a structured way. Okay. So that isn't quite like capturing the patient sort of in the wild in their natural environment. But you can foresee in the future, as we become more sophisticated, we'll be able to do that. That's actually what we're really interested in. We're interested in how the patient feels and how they function in their own social environment. And the more closer we can get to valid estimates of that, the better off we are.
If I may ask you a statistical question, I believe you've noted that the p-value of less than 0.05 is an arbitrary threshold and not a pass-fail boundary. I hope I'm not misquoting you here.
Well,
but if that's correct, is FDA's use of the p-value changing? And if so, what other tools are being used or considered to ensure confidence in study results?
The p-value is a statistical tool, but the p-value of 0.05 is a customary traditional value, the p-value. We use various statistical tools. They may generate a p-value. They may generate some other statistical estimate. And we can use many of these depending on, you know, what statistical analysis is planned to be done and that we agree upon with the sponsor. Although p-value is a variable that can assume any number practically between, you know, between one and zero practically, the decision to approve a drug or determine that you've met the substantial evidence standard of efficacy, which is required FDA, is a binary one. So we have to establish certain thresholds, yes, no. But we recognize, certainly everybody recognizes, that a p-value of 0.49 is not that much different than a p-value of 0.51, right? Mm-hmm. So there's discretion here and there's some flexibility about the p-value. The reason it's arbitrary, it is arbitrary. There's no magic and to any given p-value. And you talk to the people in the American Statistical Association, they feel that in biomedical research, the p-value is assumed of inappropriate, if I may paraphrase them, and somewhat mystical significance that it doesn't really have in statistics as well as the sense of p-value of 0.05. So we are discussing Bayesian analyses, which don't use p-values, and it's a different framework, but and it talks about the actual probability of the effect rather than the opposite or converse, which is what the p-value is. And we also use a lot of mechanism data on pathophysiology as well as drug mechanism in putting together totality of the evidence. I think for many development programs and much of science, they're going to continue to use p-values, but hopefully we bring more sophistication to our understanding of them, and we don't think they're just some kind of magic number that tells whether the study is right or not.
Well, as you suggest, this has been the magic number or mystical number for decades at this point, and even the financial community is used to looking at the p-value to make their decisions. So does this require a very significant change in mindset by a multiplicity of stakeholders?
Yes. Well, I believe that it just requires a greater education, at least in the FDA and outside, more understanding what it actually means and doesn't mean. You see studies reported out in the literature and everything, and p-values like all over the place. They have 20 p-values reported or whatever for the same experiment, right? And 40 p-values. I think just we have to bring a greater level of understanding of what we're trying to do here. But we're certainly not, we have to still have to make a binary decision on efficacy. Does it have efficacy to meet the standard or not? That's what FDA has to do. P-value, very convenient to use the p-value and have two p-values, each p less than 0.05. That's very convenient for everybody, but it's not going to work in all circumstances. And obviously it doesn't. We accept a single trial. Sometimes we accept programs where that p-value, magic p-value, hasn't been reached and so forth.
For some rare diseases, natural history of the disease may not be well understood. Mm-hmm. So the qualification of outcome measures for such diseases may not be possible in the early phases of development. What recommendations might FDA have to help sponsors plan drug development for conditions where knowledge of the disease is frankly still evolving?
Right. Well, what we do, we've been out there trying to get everybody, and we've been helping NORD. We gave NORD a grant. We've been doing all sorts of things to try and get people to collect better natural history data. Because I think you recognize that is a big risk for the sponsor and for the drug, okay, if they don't understand the natural history. And they think, well, in 2 years, these patients are going to progress by this much, right? And if you're really wrong and they're progressing in some other organ system and that's not what you measured and so forth, or it takes them longer to progress, then your study fails. And then you may have an effective drug, but you don't have anything. You have a negative study with maybe a trend. And that's like a tragedy. So it's really important to power, if you can power studies correctly and design them correctly, to understand the rate of progression of the disease and how frequently these events occur and in whom, and as much as you can about the natural history. So you're right, though. Often sponsors embark upon studies without a thorough knowledge of the natural history, and it just puts everything at much greater risk. It's frustrating for everyone.
Finally, a question about the cost-benefit of medicines. Mm-hmm. Considering global and U.S. concerns about the costs versus the benefit of medicines, of course, accepting the notion that FDA does not weigh in on drug pricing, right, what can CDER do legitimately to help ensure that an FDA-approved drug meets meaningful patient needs and is worth paying for?
Well, first of all, of course, we have a whole competition action plan under the commissioner for our generics program to make sure that where under the law it's possible to have affordable copies, that they're available to the extent that's possible. And we're doing a lot in that area, and our generic program is very successful. On the other side, most of our programs that are expedited are for serious and life-threatening diseases that lack good therapy. And for those, often it's QED, right? The people have a cancer, it's untreatable, or the treatment options are terrible and ineffective. Then to that patient group, at least, some option that extends life, say, for 6 months is a really valuable option. But then people argue about the cost, okay, and that is out of FDA's hands. But generally speaking, of course, we will review any application for a drug. That's part of our statutory mandate. So we will do that. However, we expedite those that are for serious or life-threatening illnesses that really lack good alternatives, good treatments.
A fairly common phenomenon these days, as we all know, is that regulators might approve a cancer drug that extends life by a few weeks, and the payer community will push back saying, well, that's not enough given the price. So is there a way for regulators and payers to dialogue in a way that, so as to ensure that meaningful drugs, meaningful for patients, will basically make it to market? I realize this is overreaching, perhaps, the FDA mission, but I can't resist asking, is there a middle ground here with a common understanding of what is meaningful to patients?
Well, you know, the EMA is doing some of that. In the U.S., the situation, there are many payers. Europe has maybe 27 tech assessors, right, in all their different countries. And the EMA is doing a pilot looking at, can everybody together in advance in a development program and talk about these things? That's worthwhile, but I would say your assertion is a little out of date. I think most of the cancer drugs we've been approving recently, we're talking about a revolution in cancer. I personally have talked to many people who have lung cancer, have a number of other cancers, who are working, are surviving, they've had brain mets, okay, but they're still going to work, they're still productive citizens, they're taking care of their children. These are often young people who are living kind of from one approval to another with treatments that are stabilizing their disease. So to say the old chemotherapy agents that just poisoned everything, right, those may have been approved with very short survival. Here, we're seeing progression-free survival, which means, you know, not survival, but you don't, the disease is stabilized and doesn't progress, you know, and usually it's many months. I look at most of these. So in general, drugs we're proving for cancer have much greater effectiveness than in the past, but they're very expensive. And so there is an argument, and often it's not possible to show the improved survival because that would mean people would have to be randomized to standard care, say, and that new treatment, right? And then when they progress, they would have to just not get any more treatment and just go ahead and die to prove there's a survival difference, right? And not anybody, nobody's willing to do that, really, to just stay on studies and show that they died, more people died of their cancer in the non-treatment arm. So oncologists are not willing to watch their patients progress when they have other things they could try on them. So some of the approvals are based on progression-free survivals that are durable, and we've seen really long survival, progression-free survivals, like for a year or something, you know, compared to the standard care. Well, when your tumor hasn't progressed in a year and everybody in the control group has already progressed and so forth, that's pretty impressive. So, but I understand, I think the insurance companies even had trouble with the Hep C drugs, and they still are. And I don't think anyone would really argue that curing hepatitis C isn't really important benefit for a patient not to have chronic Hep C anymore. However, they're very expensive. And so not everybody's getting treated with those drugs. So I'm not sure it's all about value. It's about partly about how much we're willing to pay in healthcare, even for beneficial interventions. And that's a perfectly reasonable issue because they're trade-offs.
Thank you for that perspective. And finally, truly finally, I wanted to ask you, in my reading of FDARA, it seems that there is, in the FDA Reauthorization Act, an emphasis on many things, but including breakthroughs on the one hand, breakthrough therapies, and on the other hand, at the other end of the spectrum, generics. So I wanted to ask, is there an intent in the Act to force, if you will, FDA to focus on drugs that are either breakthroughs or generics, in missing the middle piece of perhaps me too's or innovation that is not truly compelling or true innovation for the purpose of reducing the overall drug spend?
I don't think that there is that emphasis. The emphasis, they want us to obviously get as many generics out as possible. We've committed to do that under the second Generic Drug User Fee Act. On the other side, under Breakthrough and everything, we already ran that program. You know, it's very important for some of these really drugs that have very important treatment effects, like all the hepatitis C drugs were breakthrough, many of them were breakthrough drugs, to get them out there as soon as we're sure they're safe and effective for their intended use. But we do have a large mass of, you know, people switching to extended release and so forth. We don't have that many Me Too drugs anymore because I don't think companies can sell them. I think the market has determine that, right? Sometimes we'll get competitors and one will get on the market first and then there'll be a couple more because they've developed them in a race and a class of drugs and people get on first. But they didn't tell us to stop doing anything. They just told us to do more things.
Well, that was my final question, but Dr. Woodcock, is there any final message that you would like to give to our listeners on any topic of interest to you?
To me, the most exciting thing is this is a really fast, scientifically fascinating time for drug development. Who would have thought? We've seen the approval of the first gene therapy. We've approved antisense therapy for progressive neurologic disease. You know, we're seeing tremendous inroads in cancer with the checkpoint inhibitors and immunologic therapy. And so I think it's an exciting time to be in drug development and that we'll see advances in many areas. And I do believe one of the issues that remains and I have spent a lot of time on really is, you know, how do we get the cost of drug development to be more reasonable that the society can afford these interventions when they come out? It is a very important question.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Woodcock, for your time today. Appreciate your insights as always. Thank you so much.
Good talking to you. Thank you.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.